Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. A few years ago, when local officials were pushing for major repairs to the Sand Springs and West Tulsa levees, there were more than a few who considered the effort to be less than important due to the Keystone Dam upstream. Well, today the importance has become readily apparent, and the World War II-era levees of District 12 did hold. But it was a very close thing at times. Today we find out about the short-term and long-term fixes needed for the levee system from County Commissioner Karen Keith and District 12 Levee Commissioner Todd Kilpatrick. Throughout the flood event, both officials worked closely with the Corps of Engineers, National Guard units, and an array of federal, state, and local officials and units. As the cleanup and repairs get underway for this second 500-year flood event in the past 32 years, they join me to discuss the next steps for protecting people and property from future flood events. Commissioner Keith and Todd Kilpatrick, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us in.
Glad to be here.
Todd, let me start with you. How did the levees hold up during the flood event? This was a different flood event than the last time I think water was on the levees, which was more of a very short duration event. This was a much longer duration event. How did they hold up?
Well, I'd say they held up as expected, not as designed, because we did not have a mechanism to relieve that hydrostatic pressure that was pushing through for that long duration. So we had a lot of sand boils, and a lot of seepage was our main Achilles heel for this fight.
But at least we didn't have any breaches like we saw downstream in Russellville.
Yeah, exactly. So that was mitigated with 100 National Guardsmen a day, the Corps of Engineers, Tulsa Fire, Tulsa Police, Tulsa Sheriff's Department, and my crew.
Mitigating. The road crew.
And the Highway District 2 road crew, Scott Gray. Shout out to you. But we just mitigated that and stopped it before you have the breaches, and that was what we were doing.
Were there any close calls during the event?
There were some that we got excited about. Yes, absolutely. The floodway structure at Charles Page Boulevard and 65th, we had a lot of seepage where the structure itself wasn't in danger, but the seepage was going around the structure. That was a large one, and the next largest would probably be about a 30-foot deep sinkhole that appeared. And we have no idea where the earth went during the event. So, a lot of unknowns that we weren't ready for. The sinkholes are going to appear when you start drawing the water down off the riverside. Mm-hmm. So that suction of that water coming down is going to, any voids you have in your earth is going to magnify. So a small hole can become a big one real quick.
Now that the water is off the levees, what are the state of the levees now?
Well, a lot of the have been repaired. The sinkholes have been plugged. Still have a lot of erosion. And then, again, the flood wall structure is going to have to be definitely looked at a lot more in detail as to what's causing the underseepage and how we solve that problem.
So they're in no shape to take another flood event.
I sure wouldn't want to do it again, no, especially with this duration.
Well, what needs to happen, and this is to both of you, before the next major flood event? For the levee system.
One thing I think we need to acknowledge is that our elected officials jumped in and did what they had to do to bring us the resources to make the levee survive. Governor Stitt called in the National Guard. You had Hearn and Langford and Inhofe and their staffs throughout the duration of this paying close attention, and they have been on board to get a fix for the levee. So I think this has brought more attention to it, but I do think we have to acknowledge that without, as Todd said, without all those assets put in place, Todd couldn't have done this on his own. I mean, Todd was up, I can see, he was up in the Chinook helicopter as they were dropping these, how many, were they 400-pound bags?
2,500-pound bags.
Oh, excuse me. They were huge. And those are the kind of resources it took to make sure that the levee held through the long duration of this event.
And one of the other things I've noticed just observing this situation is all of the planning we've done in about the last 10 to 15 years on emergency management and coordinated efforts, I think, really paid off during this event.
Yeah, I mean, we love Bill Smiley with the Corps. He's done training in our neighborhoods along the line. And, I mean, I can remember that one event, Todd, you were there and you were pointing up to the rafters. This is how high it got, you know. Was that in 84 that it was up to the rafters?
No, yeah. 86.
86.
86. It was 86. Yeah. Anyway, I can just – and the neighbors were all kind of – you know, because you have different generations here now that are, you have got to educate. And so the Corps has been looking at this from two different directions. So you've got the safety side, which Bill Smiley's helped coordinate for us with Todd and the neighbors, neighborhood association, and then the side about what's the best fix. And that's been a long process.
So what does need to happen to make sure the levees are ready for the next major flood event?
We need a mechanism to hold that seepage at bay. Mm-hmm. So that was our major, if there was danger, it was danger of that seepage coming through and not being able to control it.
This is basically water on one side of the levee and finding its way through the levee.
It's pushing that hydrostatic pressure through, and we know our relief wells and tow drains are pretty much obsolete and do not control that. So that's the main key for us right now, is to find a way to control that seepage. And our pump stations, antiquated 1945 pumps, when you put a load on them that long for that duration, they didn't last.
So I mean, it's kind of like any engine, right, Todd? If you don't turn it on, it doesn't get used. It's tough.
Yeah. So you imagine running a race with a 1945 vehicle. That's what we tried to do, and we had to bring in auxiliary pumps to mitigate that flow on the land side.
Now, I know that we've done some work towards devoting money towards fixing the levee. I think it's the local match. Where are we on getting the funds to truly bring these levees into a 21st century level that we need them, given the flood events that are likely to happen?
So I do want to give a shout out to Mayor Bynum, because when he was a city councilor, he was the one person who took this issue seriously. And so in two of the packages, they put funds together to help us with the local match. So long before he became mayor, he was well aware of this issue. So he is being a great partner with us as well. So we were in, a 2 or 3 hour meeting yesterday. We've been in the middle of a feasibility study, and it was supposed to take 3 years. They're fast-tracking it, and now General Semonite was here, and he's asking us to move it even faster, which I'm so happy about that. I mean, that's the kind of attention we're getting from the Corps. They're bringing in the big dogs and saying, hey, let's get this thing moving. So he was here during that event so he could see the urgency of this project. So that's why it's been elevated so high. We are so lucky we got through this. But it wasn't just luck. Obviously, it was resources and Todd's guidance and the Corps and everybody else, all hands on deck. So this process, what do you think, Todd, now? We are looking at several different plans. We got to come to a compromise on what we want to do to move forward. And then, we were planning to break ground in probably 5 years, but I'm thinking we're moving it up.
Mm. Yeah.
What entails the fix, if you can give us a sense?
First, collectively, we need to have a tentative selective plan. And then from there, you basically take that to pre-engineering and design, which is another probably less than 2 years, and then it shovels in the ground. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the fix.
Will it be mainly a system of fortifying what you already have, of, say, fix under areas where the levee is actually a concrete wall? It'll be fixing that, or will it be moving them higher? Do we know yet?
It'll be a combination of probably everything, if I can say that. It'll be a combination of replacing 1945 equipment with modern equipment that you can actually read in time to see what's going on and not having to put people in harm's way at a pump station. So, and the floodway structure, you're going to have to basically redo that foundation and figure out what you're going to do with that, so you don't have that seepage problem that we had during this event.
And that's been kind of a choke point, too, for the whole system. So it's got to be modernized so that it actually functions better. So we're working with the team from the Corps, which has been fabulous to work with. We had some pretty strong ideas about what we wanted, but there'll have to be a compromise, and we would like to land on that in the next couple of weeks. I mean, that General Semonite is saying, I want to know how you're going to move forward, and then let's move forward.
So when you're saying compromise, you're looking for more things for Northeastern Oklahoma. The Corps saying, well, we're not sure we can do that?
No, it's just because this project is limited to levees A, B, and C.
Between the existing levees.
The existing levee. So that's what we're limited. That's the scope of what we're trying to do. It's just, how do we fix them? What kind of structure do we put in its place? So that's what we're trying to work through right now.
My guests today are Karen Keith, the Tulsa County Commissioner, Todd Kilpatrick, the District 12 Levy Commissioner. We're looking at what needs to be done to maintain the levees in Tulsa County. They worked fairly well, given their age and the situation during this latest flood event. But certainly, in the wake of climate change, we can expect more flooding events down the road, and perhaps sooner than 32 years, which was the last major flood. And obviously, they want to be ready for that role. I want to talk a little bit about the role of the Corps of Engineers during this emergency. Compared to 86, 86 was a very short flood event. This was a very different event. But how would you assess the role of the Corps in handling the flood?
My assessment was they were great. They were a great resource to have. From the beginning to the end, they were vital as far as technical advice on how and when to implement the National Guard, and they were on the ground the whole time that the Guard was there. So they were, like I said, kudos to everyone that was involved, because without that mitigation force, we would not have survived this.
Well, I think we could have communicated a little bit better to our residents out far west, town and country and so on, because initially we were told we were going to have 166,000 CFS for 4 days. Well, the very next morning it was bumped to 210, and that was so people really they just
were
that
having
was
to
too
evacuate.
Difficult.
They
had
evacuate
to run
the,
from the water.
Yeah, they
basically
had to evacuate at the last minute.
And of course these are folks who had in homes or properties that in 86 that were inundated, but for some reason FEMA mapped these as a 500-year floodplain. So that kind of lulled people into some sense of security, and they did not have flood insurance because of that. And they had mortgage companies saying, you don't need it. So, and, you know, people will opt out, and they did. So, you know, I'm thinking 90 to 95% of my folks out there don't have insurance. So FEMA is on the ground, and they're really got a trailer out there, and they're trying to help us work through this for the neighbors. We've got some properties that have had repetitive losses, and so I'm leaving later today to see if there's some buyouts. FEMA, we're having some discussions about what that would look like and who could apply and so on. What does that mean for these homeowners?
For those without flood insurance in this area, they're looking at loans. Will they be subsidized loans? I think it's
86. SBA has some low interest loans, but actually, I'm not. You know, it's just a tough deal for these homeowners that don't have insurance. I mean, some are will have to remortgage their homes. I think
And for some homeowners, if they haven't been in the home long, they're basically their mortgage is underwater.
No, we've got one couple, newlywed couple. They were in the Dominican Republic, and when all this happened, and her mother was babysitting. It's a new marriage, and she had two kids. Her mother was there with the kids and had to get out what she could in a short amount of time. But they came back to their house. It's just down to the studs. That's it.
Yeah. So in the wake of this event, what can be done on a local level, like county, city, state even, on changing this floodplain designation of 500 years, because obviously that's a consideration for the homeowners in the area.
Absolutely. The inundation maps tell the story, and so I think we're going to have to look at some remapping, and we need to find out how that mapping took place in the first place that said these properties were in the 500 year, because I think that wasn't accurate or good for the property owners.
So in the wake of this event, what other policy changes that state, county, and local government should be considering for these areas that have had issues and have been affected?
Well, as I look at the inundation maps, I see some areas that we simply need to turn back into green fields. Mm-hmm. If they're going to continually flood, I think that's the direction we need to head. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to put people back in harm's way, number one. But the risks that they take, you know, for even financially, I mean, some of these folks are absolutely devastated. And can I give a shout out to church groups that have come in here, Samaritan's Purse, for one. They have come in with their disaster relief. There's a whole list of them.
Yeah.
They have saved people's lives, literally. who thought, there's no way, how can I even do this? I've just been totally overwhelmed. And these people, and they're from Montana, from Washington State, from Philadelphia, from Austin, all over the country, and they've come in, and they just go in, and they help these people get their stuff out. And then the county has, we put in roll-offs, and we've been trying to trade them out as quickly as we can, but American Waste has been a great partner in that. But those resources are getting stretched, and the old Shell Creek landfill is taking all our stuff, and but it's quite a process. And we have a group of guys who came in with their little front loaders who are going through and picking the stuff up to put it in the dumpsters, you know. And I can't imagine how we would have done this without all those volunteers, period. I can't even begin to imagine.
I know that there's an abandoned levee out in that area, and it was abandoned a long time ago. Is there any way you could resurrect that?
I don't know. I just saw it. I didn't even know anything about it. And it's all, have you seen it, Todd?
Yes. And okay. I know after 86, there was
there was a lot of talk about that as well. Because I think most of the residents in that area thought that was still part of the levee system.
Yeah. And the Corps at the time after the 86, they did a cost-benefit ratio for the that area. And it didn't make their criteria to build a levee. So any levee that was there was pushed up by those landowners, from what I understand.
It looks more like a berm, and it's completely eroded on the riverside. I mean, it's got all these missing teeth. You know, yeah. If you look at it, it's...
Well, my guests today are Karen Keith, the Tulsa County Commissioner, and Todd Kilpatrick, the District 12 Levee Commissioner. We talk about what needs to be done to maintain the levees, especially the West Tulsa levees in Tulsa County. I have to ask you about a report that showed up in the Tulsa World earlier this week that the Corps of Engineers is conducting a study or looking to conduct a study on whether to increase capacity of Lake Keystone. I know that there was some immediate reaction to this idea. So what potential impact would a larger lake have downstream?
It's going to increase your potential for a higher magnitude flow. If we look at Keystone and the flooding that was before Keystone, our largest flows have been after the dam has been in place. In 86 and in 2019 and 84. So it's going to increase the potential for your magnitude for a higher release is going to be there in the back of everyone's mind.
I was talking when we were at the Corps yesterday. I had a sidebar conversation about this with them. And really the intent on that is to increase the capacity that the dam can hold behind it. Not so much to dump it on us, but of course, you could have that potential, obviously, but really this is about increasing the capacity. And we know from going through our studies with the Corps, they will lay out, well, we have 12 plans at one time, and one of them was very extreme with what would happen with the levee. So when they do these studies, so that whether that's really something they're going to do at the dam, that's all yet to be determined. I imagine it was one of the however many ideas they had for a fix. So,
well, I know the Corps of Engineers is not really in the dam building business these days. I mean, they don't really do a whole lot of that anymore. So because of all the regulatory red tape and litigation that usually accompanies this. So I assume this is mainly a study as much as anything else.
Hopefully I agree. Yes.
Well, that? And you know, we got a guy that works for the Corps. His name's Wade Anderson, and he is like, he just got honored as like the best dam guy in the country. He just flew back. He was in the Middle East recently working on a project there. He's here. And I toured the dam with Senator Lankford. And it was really, actually, I felt a lot more comfortable after I came out of there. Although I did see some equipment that looked as old as Todd's. they do, a pretty darn good job of maintaining that facility. And, you know, I was talking to Wade about it, and he feels absolutely confident in the integrity of that facility. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to dams.
Well, let me ask you about the next immediate steps in recovering from this event, and more importantly, for protecting property that's protected by the levee system and your role at the county. What are the immediate steps for both of you?
Right now we're doing a damage assessment to see where, you know, exactly where we're at once the water comes down, and we'll do that, and then we'll apply for funding to get the fixes that for the damage through the Public Law 8499, which is our federal insurance policy that the district has through the Corps of Engineers.
So that won't wait for the permanent fixes down the road. That will happen in the near future.
Yeah, any flood damage you had, hopefully we'll get covered with that. And then after that, we're going to get through with this feasibility study and get the hard fix and hopefully give the people that are sitting behind it the best possible level of safety you can have sitting behind a levee system. It's never 100%, and it's never going to be 100%, but we'll give you the best. We won't give you the best that we can give you.
Yeah, and on the county level?
Well, we've got some help because of our federal delegation's engagement. And then recently, the head of FEMA, Pete Gagner, was here, and he was on the ground in town and country. And so this is not necessarily for the levee, but just for taking care of some of our folks who had inundation. I think we've got the right minds to help us get rid of some of the red tape. I mean, some of the stuff can take way too long, and the homeowners need the help now. So we've had the right eyes on some of these issues, and that same group is also very much engaged with the levees. They've all walked the levees, right, Todd? We've done the dog and pony show with all of them, and they're our best advocates with the Corps pushing to get all these fixes. But I'm really hoping that with the head of FEMA having been here, that we will get a response for these flood victims in cutting the red tape and a better time.
And since you brought it up, is the buyout, the possibility of buyout for certain homes that have had repeated floods a possibility in these neighborhoods?
I would think it is a possibility. It's called repeated loss. And I'm actually going from here to a meeting to talk about that. So if we get some buyouts in place, the feds, I believe, cover about 75%, and then the state and the county will split the other part.
All right. Karen and Todd, thank you very much for all your hard work over the last couple of weeks, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Rich, for bringing attention to this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Tulsa County Commissioner Karen Keith and District 12 Levy Commissioner Todd Kilpatrick talking about the short-term and long-term fixes for the levee system and for property owners affected by recent flooding along the Arkansas River. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
The title of this commentary is Oklahoma in Excelsis. It has three parts, like a play. Part one, the background. Here's the news. New York has discovered Oklahoma. At least New York Magazine has. Frank Rich wrote a recent article titled Oklahoma Was Never Really Okay, which is a review of the new version of the musical Oklahoma and some state history that is shocking and informative to some people. How many copies of this article did people send you? I got 5. This was moderately annoying because I wrote a commentary for this self-same radio station about the new versions of Oklahoma last August. One version is set in an all-black town, and another version has same-sex couples for Lori and Curly and Ado Annie and Will Parker. Well, I guess everybody didn't hear it. They're busy in New York. The version just opening on Broadway has a dark spin and a weird interpretation. It has Judd, whom we all know is the villain, as a sympathetic character who isn't killed accidentally by Curly, but deliberately. In cold blood, to illustrate what a dark and troubled place Oklahoma was and is. Judd represents everyone victimized by brutality. Now, supposedly Lynn Riggs intended to have Judd killed deliberately, but the makers of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical prettied that up and said, "We don't have murders in the second act." Beyond the musical, Mr. Rich has discovered the real Oklahoma, and he is slack-jawed to learn that we lead the nation in female incarceration, are close to the top in the poverty level, poor public health, anti-LGBT legislation, and had the worst black massacre in American history in Tulsa, plus the serial murders in Osage County. Ho hum, we know that. Which brings me to the present, part two. I think he sells us short. There's a lot more to us than that. How about abortion? Hate it. Gun control? Hate it. Cannabis? Well, that starts with a C and that rhymes with T and that stands for trouble, trouble right here in Oklahoma. Which brings me to part three, the more distant past. The play is set in 1906 near Claremore, and the area wasn't Oklahoma then, it was still Indian territory. If most of the people had their way, it would not have become Oklahoma. Indian territory would have become a separate state named Sequoia. But Congress wouldn't approve that, and so the twin territories were merged into one state in 1907 as Oklahoma. Now, Mr. Rich is right that the state has a dark and troubled history, more than he knows. It was the end of the Trail of Tears, the catastrophic results of Andrew Jackson's governmental policy of forcing the five civilized tribes to leave their homelands east of the Mississippi and be relocated here. So many natives died on that trip, 1/4 of some tribes. I've heard it called America's Holocaust. To this day, some Indians will not carry a $20 bill because it has the image of Andrew Jackson on it. The tribes were promised this land in perpetuity. As one tribal leader explained the treaty, as long as sun rises, it shall last. As long as the waters run, it shall last. As long as the grass grows, it shall last. Well, the sun rose and set, and the federal government broke one treaty after another. Originally, the relocated tribes owned all of what is currently Oklahoma, except the panhandle. Then, some of the tribes allied with the Confederacy during the Civil War, and a punitive U.S. government took back the western half of the state and opened it for homestead settlement. And then, to quench the white hunger for more land and to assimilate the Indians, the federal government set aside the treaties for eastern Oklahoma, broke up tribal governments, allotted lands held communally by the tribes to individuals, and opened the door to more whites. By statehood, an exploding white population outnumbered the Indians 5-1. The principal chief of the Creek Nation said, "They flowed all over us," and they wanted more land. In 1908, Congress passed an act that released about 70% of the Indian allotments from restrictions and placed the natives under state probate, which meant county courts. The system was as full of holes as a Swiss cheese and vulnerable to graft. That began what Oklahoma's premier historian Angie DeBow called an orgy of plunder and exploitation unparalleled in American history. Everything from forgery to kidnapping to murder. Progress and greed went hand in hand in one of the blackest eras of Oklahoma. Corrupt judges, attorneys, businessmen, and individuals of all stripes scrambled to rob the Indians of their land and their valuable rights for timber, coal, asphalt, and oil. Millions of dollars, thousands of acres. The scope of this corruption was far worse than what David Grann wrote about in Killers of the Flower Moon in the Osage Nation. Here in eastern Oklahoma, we live on stolen, bloodied ground. And shame. So, Mr. Rich, if you want to talk about Oklahoma's dark history, come on down. I'll put the coffee pot on and we'll talk till morning.
Connie Cronley is a columnist for Tulsa People magazine and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.